Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for December 1st, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews up tonight, the usual two interviews. First, in about 10 minutes, we'll be hearing from Anatole Levin, a fellow at the New America Foundation, who had an op-ed piece in the Financial Times the other day with the catchy headline, "Decadent America Must Give Up Imperial Ambitions." So I gave Levin a call, a frequent guest in this show, but I thought it was a good opportunity for him to dilate on that headline. Journalists, of course, authors are not responsible for the headlines that their articles are given usually, but that one actually rather succinctly captures the argument. And we'll hear from him in about now 9 minutes. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded a couple of weeks ago with Heather Rogers, author of a book called Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, about solid waste, where it comes from, where it goes, and what we can do about it. That book just out from the New Press. Before we get to all that, a couple of the news headlines, economic news headlines. First of all, a couple of days ago, the Commerce Department revised its estimate of third quarter gross domestic product. All economic statistics are revised continuously. GDP numbers revised generally three times and then revised again years later. Sometimes quite significantly. Employment numbers revised significantly. Income numbers revised significantly. So there's a saying on Wall Street, it's hard to predict anything, especially the present. That's certainly the case. These are just estimates. They're good estimates. They're done by honest, competent people, but they are just estimates because this is a very complicated, elusive, and hard-to-measure thing, an economy. But anyway, the previous report for growth in the third quarter was 3.8%. That was revised up to 4.3%. Pretty good number and the best we've seen in quite some time. Personal consumption was revised up, residential investment, that is spending on housing, revised up. But interestingly, income was revised down. So we had spending revised up, income revised down. Now the savings rate for the U.S. Households equal to minus 1.5% of personal income, after-tax personal income. That's the worst number since 1933. We've now had two consecutive quarters of negative personal savings rates, five out of the last 7 months negative personal savings rates. It was reported this morning that the October personal savings rate was minus 0.7%. People really, really living beyond their means with an unprecedented degree. It's kind of scary. And we hear a lot of reasons why that's nothing to worry about, but it does seem kind of scary that people are either dissaving, as economists say, which means either drawing down their savings or borrowing money and spending more than their income. But in any case, all that red ink, which is now financed mostly by money coming from abroad, just doesn't have the ring of sustainability about it. But consumer attitude is getting much more upbeat. They took a big hit after the hurricanes and the gas price spike and spent most of September heading downwards. They bottomed out in the middle of September, and now they've been heading upwards. And the ABC Money Magazine weekly measure of ABC News, Washington Post. It used to be the Money Magazine. It's now the Washington Post is their partner in that. That measure, weekly measure, up 2 points. Now, up 6 points from its low, although the improvement led by better-off people and Republicans and white people. So things looking better if you're on the top of the social heap, things not looking so much better if you're not. But anyway, in any case, the deep economic pessimism that took hold after the gas price spike lifting somewhat, although it's still below its levels of the summer. I think that reflects a weak job market, weak income growth. Not true if you're at the top of the heap, but for everyone else, things are not going so great. that housing market showing some signs of that bubble, the housing market showing some signs of losing air. Existing home sales, that is, old houses just resold, off by 2.7% in the month of October, and now considerably below the peaks recorded 6 months ago. So the housing market at least showing some signs of cooling down, although new home sales, a much smaller market, about a quarter of the size of the existing home sales market. But that up very sharply in October, contradicting a lot of other housing measures. But this series is quite volatile, and it may not be sustained. The Mortgage Bankers Association's weekly tally of mortgages also off its peaks. So it looks like the housing market slowing down. There are some more excitable sorts who think that it's about to fall apart and lead us into perdition. That may be an exaggeration. The British housing market had quite a run. It topped out about 2-3 years ago and has just been heading sideways ever since. So we could see something like that. But even a sideways housing market would lead to a considerable could lead to a considerable slowdown in the U.S. economy, because it's been housing, the optimism that rising house prices has been generating in owners, and all the borrowing against that appreciated house value that people have been doing has been fueling spending. So we'll see. The British retail sales, British consumption showing taking a hit, reflecting the slowdown in their housing market, and we might see the same here. And God knows the overextended American household does need to slow down a bit. The Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly measure of a leading index, which is designed to forecast twists and turns in the economy several months ahead, falling last week and now considerably off its peaks from still not going negative, but it is suggesting a slowing pace in the economy early next year, early middle next year, from it's off its peaks scaled in September. Finally, the weekly tally of jobless claims, that is, people who've just lost their jobs, head over to sign up for unemployment insurance benefits, that off 17,000 last week, and finally settling down after the spike that it saw in September over as a result of the hurricanes. So it's suggesting a good but not great job market. Tomorrow morning we'll see the release of the November employment statistics. I'm expecting, again, an okay number but nothing great, not too strong, and quite possibly the Federal Reserve having raised interest rates now at 12 consecutive policy meetings. That rise in interest rates may finally be slowing things down a bit, although there's considerable optimism among Wall Streeters. There's, I think, a lot less optimism among ordinary folks. And the reason for that, I think, is this job market, which is generating some employment, but not as much as it should, and generating no wage growth at all to speak of, except for the top 1 to 2% of the income distribution. So this does seem reminiscent in many ways of the economy of the 1980s, which looked like a boom on the surface, but actually saw a stagnant to falling incomes below that surface. And let's take a little musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Anatole Levin. And that a bit from the Randy Newman, Mark Knopfler song, It's Money That Matters, lurking in bookstores and working in the public radio. All those gifted people, smarter than Randy, but in a fair system they'd be thriving, but here they're barely just getting by. Speaking of not having enough money to get by, it does seem like the American empire is at something of that kind of pass. Anatole Levin, who is a fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., had a piece in the Financial Times the other day, November 29th, to be precise. I think that's Tuesday, with the catchy headline, Decadent America Must Give Up Its Imperial Ambitions. He argues that we're just overextended and creating disaster. And I know that what you're about to hear is not the kind of anti-imperialist polemic that lots of folks would might prefer, but Levin is a very well-informed, thoughtful, and articulate analyst and always worth listening to. So let's listen to Anatole Levin, an interview I recorded yesterday.
You pronounced the American empire bust. What are your reasons for that? That's not a popular view right now.
Well, I think it is quite popular. It's just that people don't state it quite so clearly or in those words. But, I mean, what is the call for American soldiers to withdraw from Iraq, if not an admission that the American empire, as conceived by the Bush administration and the neoconservatives, is bust? You can't run their idea of global domination or even hegemony over the Middle East without, you know, being prepared to occupy places for very long periods and lose a lot of lives and spend an enormous amount of money in the process. The whole Rumsfeldian idea that this could be done on the cheap was simply nonsense in historical or economic terms. People have recognized just how expensive it is, and they're not prepared to pay the price in either blood or treasure. Now, that's not an argument against American global leadership. Don't get me wrong. I've always believed that America can and should exercise that kind of leadership. But it is an argument against the kind of megalomaniac desire for, you know, controlling the situation in many different parts of the world that has been characteristic of the Bush administration, at least, you know, in its first years in power.
Was there ever a time in history when the U.S. could have accomplished a goal like the occupation of a country? The U.S. failed in Vietnam, that was certainly, by some accounts, the high point of American power.
I don't think that at any point in its history outside North America, the U.S. Would have been prepared to fight an operation like this endlessly. It was prepared to do something like this in the Philippines, of course, after 1898. But, you know, that was a limited operation. It was relatively cheap. And after a few years, they did succeed in pacifying the Philippines, more or less. Of course, on the North American continent, the United States was prepared to fight low-level campaigns like this, you know, against the Red Indians for many decades, even centuries, you could say. But no, I don't think that at any point in American history, the U.S. would really have, or the American public would have agreed to this kind of imperial rule. I don't think that the American public is imperialist. I think this is the key mistake, you know, made by both the neocons but also their allies in the kind of hardline realist camp. They just misinterpreted their own people. They sat happily behind their desks. Not one of these people have served themselves, of course, one must remember, and believed that other people would be willing to go on paying indefinitely and would be prepared to send American soldiers to die for this imperial project. And they're not.
There does seem to be a lot at stake here. Certainly the Bush administration staked its reputation on success in Iraq and their broader global vision, but also withdrawal from Iraq would send strange messages about American credibility, as they used to say back in the Vietnam era. Certainly Iraq itself is not just an ordinary country. It's got lots of oil below its surface. So can they really get out of this thing gracefully?
I don't think they can get out of it gracefully. I think by now it's a question of just how ungracefully they can get out and how much damage for the U.S., for the region, for the world results from this. My own view is that the only way to prevent Iraq after the American withdrawal turning into a regional disaster is to establish a new relationship with certain critical regional states, most notably Iran and Syria, because the greatest threat of all is that there will be a full-scale civil war. I mean, there's already a growing but contained small-scale civil war between Kurds, Sunni Arabs and Shia. The risk is, though, that if or rather when the US withdraws, this will become a full-scale conflict, and that regional states will be drawn in on opposite sides. Now, that could lead to a situation which would destabilize the whole of the Middle East and potentially bring down the governments or the whole states in key American allies like Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's the ultimate nightmare. So one needs to get regional states together to, you know, to talk about their real interests in Iraq and above all their interests in containing and limiting future conflict. Because, you know, there's already a lot of talk about how the US must bring in the international community or must bring in Europe to help with Iraq. In my view, this is completely irrelevant. There is nothing serious that Europe can do to help there. There's certainly nothing serious that the UN or the international community can do to help there. This is going to be principally a job for Muslims and Arabs themselves, but with the US, you know, obviously trying to guide and help them. But of course, any such opening to Tehran in particular would require something approaching a revolution in American foreign policy and in American domestic politics as well. I mean, along the same lines as Nixon and Kissinger's opening to China in the early 1970s, but even more painful.
Is anybody in Washington capable of making this kind of change? It seems to me that the Democrats don't really have much of an idea of what to do. They seem to enjoy to watch the Republicans squirm, but do they really have a concept of an alternative foreign policy?
No, I'm afraid they don't. And that's particularly true in the Middle East. And the reason is that they are as constrained by the same domestic political factors as the Republicans are. In fact, some of the Republicans, like Brent Scowcroft, are actually freer than the Democrats to say what they think. But, you know, the opening to China would not have been possible for either of the main American political parties in 1964, say, before America went into Vietnam. The Johnson administration couldn't have done it, and nor could a Republican administration then. 7 years later, and after 60,000 American dead, and God knows how many Vietnamese dead, it turned out that it was possible. I'm just praying that it won't take that level of casualties to produce a change of heart this time around.
Gallup pointed out recently that American public opinion on Iraq is now where it was in Vietnam after 20,000 deaths. Has something changed in American domestic politics to make these kinds of foreign adventures more difficult?
I think it has to some extent, yes. The population has become more demilitarized, if you will, more hostile to military adventures. It's particularly striking, of course, because those 20,000 dead in Vietnam were deaths of conscripts, whereas this time around it is, after all, professional volunteers. But I don't think it's just that. I mean, America went into Vietnam with the full support, or the almost full support, of both political parties, and indeed a general consensus in the policy-making community. It was quite different in the case of Iraq. I mean, although the Bush administration was able to, you know, basically deceive and intimidate a lot of the political opposition into acquiescence, the Iraq operation was always much more contested than Vietnam. You had far more policy experts, leading retired soldiers, anti-terrorism experts from before the war, in the whole debate leading up to the war, declaring that not merely was this the idea a bad thing in itself, the idea of invading and occupying Iraq, but that it was actually counterproductive to the war on terror, that this was going to make the struggle against Al-Qaeda and the people responsible for 9/11 even more difficult, that this was going to help Al-Qaeda. It was pointed out that, contrary to the line being suggested by the Bush administration, that, of course, Iraq had had nothing to do with 9/11. So I think that this whole war has been much more contested in American politics from the start than Vietnam was, and therefore has always been less legitimate in the eyes of a great many Americans.
I'm speaking with Anatole Lieben, who is a fellow at the New America Foundation based in Washington, D.C. We're speaking a few hours after Bush laid out his vision for victory in Iraq. Did that speech give any signs that he's joined the reality-based community?
Yes, in the sense that he now recognizes that America is going to have to get out fairly soon. I mean, that was the obvious message of his speech, that domestically, I mean, if it doesn't, there is no chance, in my view, of the Republicans winning the next presidential elections. But on the other hand, he could only justify this withdrawal in terms of what he's said to be America's mission. By essentially making up information about the progress of creating an Iraqi army, which is contradicted, frankly, by every objective, witness from the ground. I don't know if you saw Jim Fallows' piece in the last Atlantic Monthly about the real state of the Iraqi army. It really looks as if there's no way at present that the Iraqis can take over security responsibility from the U.S., which means, of course, that I opposed this war from the beginning, but now I do think that America should be careful about simply cutting and running, because if it does that, leaving no serious Iraqi security structures behind, then, of course, the chances of it becoming a really full-scale and disastrous civil war are not so much high, I would say, as virtually inevitable.
Well, let's look forward a bit to a new American foreign policy that could emerge sometime in the future. Would the American relationship with Israel have to be reconsidered if we were to come up with a more rational approach to the outside world?
To some degree, yes. It's clear that to create this opening to Tehran, to create a new relationship with Syria, to try to create a new security consensus in the Middle East as a whole, the more extreme or exaggerated elements of the influence of the Israel lobby in Washington would have to be rejected and cut down to size, because, of course, the Israel lobby has been lobbying very hard against just this, I mean, against Tehran and against Damascus. So, yes, and also there would have to be a lot more U.S. pressure for a genuine and stable peace settlement between Israel and the Palestinians, not the kind of very limited concessions which it still seems is all that Sharon is prepared to contemplate, even after his break with Likud. I should say, though, that in my view, this neither would nor should involve the U.S. abandoning its support for Israel and its guarantee of Israeli security. On the contrary, it would mean the U.S. Simply advocating in Israel and to Israel what I, and indeed many Israelis, including the new head of the Labour Party in Israel, would regard as a much more sensible and, in the long term, much safer version of what Israeli security actually requires.
And you cite the writings of Harvard professor Stephen Walt on offshore balancing. What's that all about?
Yes, well, this is an IR term. It's a little academic, but basically it means the U.S. Getting out of involvement on the ground in a region, and then playing off one state in the region against the other, as in the past, for example, the U.S. played off Iraq against Iran, regarding Iran as the greater threat, or played off Pakistan against India when India was an ally of the Soviet Union, or to some extent today is playing off Japan against China. I think there's something to that. I mean, this is always going to be part of any American or any other outside power strategy in the Middle East, because, of course, there are these tremendous fears, hatreds, and rivalries between the local states. However, I think in the context of Iraq, but also in the future context of maintaining peace and order in in the Middle East and guaranteeing oil supplies. Actually, this kind of offshore balancing is not enough, because, of course, it actually risks, to some degree, encouraging regional conflict, as it did the war between Iraq and Iran after 1979. So I think that, as far as possible, the United States should aim instead at a security framework and a security consensus in the region. And the first, for me, the first step towards that is bringing states to a recognition of the fact that if Iraq does turn into a general war, then all of them, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, are all likely to suffer very badly, even catastrophically, as a result.
Finally, there's a long-standing tension in American public opinion between the elites, which prefer engagement or leadership or whatever kind of word you'd like to apply to it, and popular opinion, which has been much more inward-looking or isolationist. It looks like Iraq may be leading us to a relapse of the Vietnam syndrome, a turn towards isolationism. Is that the way things look to you?
I think to some degree, yes. But of course, as the U.S. discovered after Vietnam, American interests around the world are now both so wide and so deep that it isn't possible for the U.S. to retreat into anything like, you know, old-style isolationism of the kind that America pursued in the 1920s and 30s. That would be disastrous for American interests. And by the way, I think disastrous for regional interests as well. I believe in American leadership in principle. So the task, I think, for the American policy community is to craft a line which falls somewhere between the present very, very dangerous overextension of American power at the one end and real isolationism on the other. And that, for me, requires, you know, supporting American leadership, but placing it on a more limited and therefore a firmer footing.
And is anybody surrounding you in Washington thinking in this direction?
Yes, a lot of them are, actually, but not, you know, in the summits of power, if you like, neither in the administration, obviously, nor in Congress, nor indeed in some of the main think tanks. But a lot of individuals around the place are thinking along these lines. And I think one of the key challenges over the next couple of years will be for people who really want to express this in politics to try to bring this kind of expertise together and give it a political vehicle. The interesting thing is that in 2008, that vehicle could be either Democratic or Republican. One can see a Republican candidate running on this kind of program just as easily as one can a Democrat. Equally, I'm afraid, one can see either a Democrat or a Republican actually running on a kind of more cautious version of the existing approach to the world, which in my view is simply a continuation of America's overextension and a risk of future disasters down the line.
And that the voice of Anatole Levin, a prolific author and a fellow at the New America Foundation based in Washington, D.C., interview recorded yesterday. Let's take a little station break, and I'll be back.
Hi, this is Steve Earle, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio. And support WBAI, Peace and Justice Radio in New York.
Steve Earle, that's pretty cool. This is Behind the News. My name is Doug Kenwood, and you can also find us on the web at WBAI.org, where you can also make a pledge to support this and other fine programming going out on our airways and in our archives and over the magic of the Internet. Let's take a little musical break to set up Heather Rogers.
What?
And that a little bit from the Cramps song Garbage Man. And I apologize for playing all this old music. I do like to play something new now and then, but it all seems so appropriate. This is, of course, introducing Heather Rogers, author of a book called Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, just published by the New Press. A very intelligent and very well-written book, as well as being a very informative one on the solid waste problem. This interview recorded a couple of weeks ago, didn't get to broadcast it for a few weeks, but here it is finally. Heather Rogers, Gone Tomorrow. Most people don't want to think about garbage. They just want to throw it out and not think about it again. You've stared it in the face. How'd you get into garbage?
I got interested in garbage because I wanted to know what happened to my garbage, because it seemed like it disappeared, but I knew that it didn't. And so in order to understand also more fully how a city works, I wanted to know what happened to my garbage, because it's such an integral part of how urban spaces function. Once I started looking at it, I realized that it was a great way to talk about the way that the market works. And I was thinking going into it that I would be confronted with environmental issues, but what kept cropping up again and again was issues that related more and more to the market.
What do you mean, relating to the market?
What I mean is that what I learned was that garbage is central to the way that capitalism works. Capitalism needs garbage. It needs waste to keep making new markets, to keep stimulating consumption and getting people to buy new things. If they don't throw their old things out, then there isn't room for more consumption.
All right, let's follow some garbage. Let's say in New York City, the way my apartment building works, I put the garbage out the door twice a day, and it disappears, and I don't think about it anymore. So where might it go?
What happens to your garbage when it leaves the door is that it goes to what's called a transfer station. It gets picked up, first of all, it gets picked up by a compaction garbage truck, and those were developed during World War II, and they're hydraulic trucks that compress waste because collection is the most expensive part of waste disposal and handling. And so what they want to do is maximize the efficiency of that process. So if they can compact more garbage into one load, then it makes the process cheaper. So first of all, your garbage goes into a compaction truck and it gets crammed in with all the other garbage. And the reason that that's significant is that if you want to salvage something, it makes it much more difficult because everything gets compressed together. From there, it goes to what's called a transfer station. And a transfer station is basically a processing area where recyclables and garbage get sorted and loaded onto larger trucks, semi-trailers. And from there, they go either to the recycling center or a broker if it's paper or cans or bottles. And if it's household garbage, it goes to either an incinerator or most often to the landfill.
Well, we do have some, not a state-of-the-art recycling program in New York City, but we do have some recycling. What happens with recycled materials? Do they actually live again as commodities, or where do they end up?
A shocking number of the items that New York residents dutifully separate do not get recycled. They don't get remade into new commodities. And the numbers are kind of shocking, but only half of all paper gets recycled. Half of all aluminum cans get recycled. Only a third of all glass bottles get recycled. And a staggeringly low 5% of all plastic gets recycled. So most of these things that people think get recycled aren't actually getting recycled. And there are two reasons. The main reason is the market. There simply isn't a market for recyclable commodities because the virgin inputs, you know, virgin sources of paper and metal, aluminum and glass and plastic more than any of the other materials, the virgin inputs are cheaper and they're more consistent, so they work better within the industrial processes that require uniform and predictable qualities. And you can't get that from recycled stocks.
And recycled goods have to confront a fact of not nature, but physics or something called downcycling. What's that?
Yeah, that's the second reason why substances aren't recycled as often as we would perhaps like them to be. And downcycling is just, on the chemical level, all materials except some metals begin to break down pretty quickly. The paper fibers grow shorter. The chains in the glass molecules and in the plastic molecules become less workable and don't hold together as well, and it's just more difficult to use that material. So this is something that's really significant to keep in mind for people that are in favor of recycling and promote recycling as a means of environmental activism, which a lot of people do, is that there are real limits to recycling as a long-term solution. It's something in, I argue this in the book, it's something that we should use, but we need to keep in perspective its limits.
A lot of stuff ends up in landfills. First of all, where do these landfills come from? How did we start dumping garbage in landfills?
What I look at in the book is, I mean, I talk about early forms of land dumping, which go through all these different phases of improvements, and that culminates in the 1930s with the first sanitary landfill, which was built in Fresno, California in 1934 by a sanitation engineer named Gene Vincennes. And he created, using technology that he imported from Britain, he created the precursor to what we have now, which we still call the sanitary landfill. And it uses the same idea of compressing and compacting waste into the ground and then covering it over with a layer of dirt and using minimal labor to do this. One person operating the crane and the machinery at the landfill and another person doing the dumping. So you have, or maybe two people doing the dumping. So you have this minimal demands on labor, which lowers the cost, and also the technology of covering the garbage with dirt kept rats out, it kept the smells down, and compressing the waste kept moisture out. And so it created this really efficient system, which was then improved tremendously during World War II by the Army Corps of Engineers, who drafted Gene Vincennes to come and improve and perfect the sanitary landfill for its domestic bases. And then he taught the method to all these engineers who then after the war went back home and started building sanitary landfills all over the country.
I should say I'm speaking with Heather Rogers, author of the book Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, just out from the New Press. And you visit a state-of-the-art landfill. Tell us what that's like.
I had nightmares after I went to the state-of-the-art landfill. The landfill that I went to is called the Groves Landfill, and it's operated by Waste Management Incorporated in Pennsylvania. And Groves stands for Geological Reclamation Operations and Waste Systems, but it's an apt name because it's one of the company's largest landfills, and it's the number one recipient of New York City's garbage in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania is the number one recipient of exported garbage in the country. And the landfill is surreally located in this landscape that was formerly a U.S. Steel. Just next to it is a mostly decommissioned U.S. steel plant. And the landfill is on this plot of land that was owned by a surface mining company, and in the earlier part of the 20th century, they mined the land for materials to make cement, which they then used for construction in Philadelphia. But so now the land that was you know served as a mine is now being filled with garbage, and so it has this interesting history. But when I say that the landscape is surreal, it's surreal because Waste Management, in their consciousness about getting bad publicity for destructive and polluting practices, has created this nature reserve on the site of the landfill. And just next to the Groves landfill is another very large landfill and an incinerator on the same site. It's 6,000 acres. It's huge. And then there's this man-made lake, and you can go hunting and fishing and camping there. And when they were showing me around, they were pointing out the birds and talking about how great it is that people can go camping and fishing there and how you can't smell anything. And it's true, you can't smell anything. But we know that these sites are incredibly toxic. They're environmental time bombs. Landfills are disasters waiting to happen.
Well, why is that? Don't we separate out the toxic waste, or is it all mixed up in there?
There are so many wastes that come, that flow out of our homes and our offices that are seemingly benign when you think about them individually, like a battery or a bottle of bleach or a can of paint. But when those things get mixed together in the concentrations that they do in these landfills, like the Groves landfill gets thousands of tons of garbage a day. And when you have that concentration of all of those toxic substances and plastics and adhesives and solvents mixed together with biological components, just like, you know, food waste, when those biological organic materials start to break down, they start interacting with these chemicals and they create new chemicals, and those chemicals mix together, and that creates more hazardous air pollutants and volatile organic compounds that leach into that create what's called leachate, which is the liquid wastes that come out of landfills. And it also creates what's called landfill gas, which is very toxic gas that's emitted by these landfills. And leachate is captured by these high-tech landfills. They're required to have liners, and they're required to capture the leachate and treat it. And they're also required to drill wells to capture the gas. But according to the EPA, these liners won't last forever, and there's no way of knowing what's going to happen, you know, in the coming decades.
As I recall, New York City generates, 26,000 tons of garbage a day, and we're just 2.5% of the nation's population, and the United States is just 5% of the world's population. It seems like we have a big problem in our hands. How much longer can we just keep filling holes with trash before it catches up with us?
That all depends on your definition of catching up with us. In theory, there's enough land in the U.S. that finding a place to bury all our garbage isn't technically an issue. There's plenty of space to put it. In fact, today there's an overcapacity of landfill space. And also, just to point out, we're talking about landfills a lot because 85% of what gets disposed of goes to landfills. A much greater proportion of our waste goes to landfills than to incinerators. So it's important to note that there's no shortage of space to put all these wastes. It just gets more expensive the farther out you have to go. So there's an incentive for waste disposal companies to keep their landfills that are within proximity to cities like New York and Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago, to keep those landfills up and running as long as they can. It's tricky because there's an incentive for them to keep those up and running as long as they can, but also if they keep them running for too long and maybe the liners break, then they might have, you know, some serious environmental problems on their hands. So they're in a precarious situation as well. But so there are different limits to what we can throw away. The real something that's important to think about when we think about garbage isn't just where does garbage go, but where does it come from? And the toll that that takes on the environment, because everything that gets thrown away has gone through a long process of raw material extraction and production and distribution in order for us to consume it and throw it away. And all of those processes take a massive toll on the environment. And that's where we see the connection between garbage and larger environmental crises like global warming.
Why can't we burn it all?
Burning garbage is problematic. It's very toxic, and there are a lot of people that dispute this. I've had an exchange in particular with Benjamin Miller, who wrote a great book called Fat of the Land about garbage in New York City, and he is a big proponent of incineration. And I've read a lot of things, and I'm still not convinced that it's a safe method to dispose of our waste. According to the UN Environmental Program, incineration is responsible for almost 70% of worldwide dioxin emissions, and dioxin is one of the most toxic chemicals on the planet. So incineration is a dirty business, and I think that what is more important in terms of finding solutions for what to do with our garbage is to reduce the amount of garbage we make. And I don't think it's that difficult, and I also don't think that it would have that detrimental of an effect on our economy to reduce the amount of waste we make.
I'm speaking with Heather Rogers, author of Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage, just out from the New Press. So let's talk a little bit about, so it's the last 5 or 10 minutes of an interview, is the what is to be done question. In some sort of green socialist paradise where we were free of the fetters and demands of capitalism, what might the waste stream look like?
Something that I think about that would be pretty great is if somehow, well, if we had greater product durability and serviceability. So like if your cell phone breaks and you need to replace a part, you can. You don't have to throw it away and get a new one if you don't want to. Also, the same is true. I mean, there's so many...
But that means changing the way things are designed, and that removes considerable amounts of profit from the process.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that it removes profit from the process. But it's important to consider, I mean, this argument has been made for a long time by manufacturers that if there is increased product durability and serviceability, and if there is reduced waste, and if we do have tighter environmental controls on production, that it will necessarily reduce the number of jobs and lower people's standard of living. And what in fact has happened is that we've lived with the opposite of that, with, you know, basically unfettered, some people would dispute that, but largely unfettered production processes. And what we've gotten is, since the year 2000, we've had over 2 million jobs leave the country. We've had those replaced by half as many service sector jobs that are low paying. There's greater economic polarization today than there's been in 50 years. And what that translates into is a lower standard of living for more and more Americans. So the high waste, and the point of saying that is that the high waste lifestyle that we've embraced actually doesn't deliver the most goods to the most people. It benefits the people at the top. And so if you redesign the production process so that there is less waste, so that there is more product serviceability and durability, it will redistribute profits. And if you go, which I talk about in the book, if you, for example, go back to a refillable bottling system for beverages so that we don't throw away or pretend to recycle the bottles that we use and actually use refillable bottles, which can be reused anywhere, I've read anywhere from 15 to 40 times, then what you end up having are more local jobs, because it forces there to be local centers for this repair to take place, for this refilling of bottles to take place, and it decentralizes capital in a way that stimulates local economies, and it creates jobs, and it creates well-paying, skilled jobs on a local level.
I bought a cable for my iPod a few weeks ago, and it came in a beautiful box, wrapped in plastic. And certainly that contributes to the fetish value of the commodity. But what is the contribution of packaging to the waste stream?
Packaging is such a huge part of the waste stream. It's 30%. It takes up 30% of all landfill space in the U.S. And it keeps growing. And most new packaging is plastic. And plastic is pretty amazing stuff. Honestly, you know, it's beautiful to look at. It's completely perfect for the way that capitalism works. Like, it's perfect for the free market system. It can be created on demand as needed in the colors and shapes and textures to suit your wildest dreams. and yet it's completely toxic, and it's toxic to make, it's toxic to use, it's toxic to dispose of. And so it has all these problems that really need to be addressed. The other thing about your question is that there's something that we need to honestly address about packaging. Packaging came about as a thing because it does appeal to real human desire. And there is something, you know, real about wanting to get that object off the shelf and possess it and buy it and maybe even throw it away. I mean, maybe there's also a pleasure in that too, that, you know, the environmental movement I think needs to take seriously. And how can we use those desires and tap into those desires and not just say, no, we must not do this, this is bad, but somehow tap into that and use that in our favor.
Have you solved that one yet? is that a project for future study?
That's a project for future study.
but does studying garbage induce despair, or does it all seem so like we're just going to choke on this stuff and there's no way out of it, or do you actually think we can get a handle on it?
I think that we can get a handle on it. I think it's very. I don't feel very optimistic right now under the Bush administration and the changes also that are happening in Europe, the shift toward neoliberal economic reform in other parts of the world is distressing. But I think that we don't have to look far to see policies that work really well. And some of them are in places like Germany, where they have a law that says 72% of all bottles have to be refillable bottles for beverages. And that's a law that was passed in 1991 under a conservative government. And they passed it because they were running out of landfill space and incineration capacity. And it's been very successful. And it's also very popular. People like to take their bottles back. And this is the flip side of enjoying consuming packaging, is that it's also really distressing for people, I think, to throw so much away. I mean, there's a real kind of psychological toll that takes. And when people can do something, I mean, that's why recycling is so popular, even though it's not as effective as most people would like it to be. It's really popular because it gives people, it's this act that connects them to the production process that they're totally alienated from in the system. And taking their bottles back in Germany and in other countries that do it in Europe, it's popular among the vast majority of consumers. And so that's something that I think we can also take heart in.
And that's the voice of Heather Rogers, author of the book Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. She also made a movie on that topic several years ago. With the same title. That book just out from the New Press, very excellent, informative, intelligent, and well-written book, and everyone should pick up a copy. Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage by Heather Rogers. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with a little bit more garbage music, this from the New York Dolls.
Won't pick it up. Don't try to.